You're listening to Becoming Wildly Resilient, brought to you by University of Kentucky Human Resources Health and Wellness. Join us as we explore tools, practices, meditations, and conversations with the members of the UK community. Together, we will discover how we can thrive at work, home, and beyond. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Becoming Wildly Resilient Conversations. My name is Sebastian Kalmes. I'm a wellness specialist with UK HR Health and Wellness and your host for today's episode. Today on the show, we're going to be talking about awe and beauty. My guest is Dr. David Bradshaw. Dr. Bradshaw, thank you for being on the show with me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
How long have you been at UK?
27 years.
Can you tell me a little bit about your role right now?
Well, I'm in the philosophy department, and my specialty is ancient Greek philosophy. I also teach medieval philosophy, philosophy of religion.
27 years at UK, that's a lot of research and teaching. What were some of the main factors that led you to your interest in ancient philosophy and philosophy of religion?
I was in physics as an undergraduate. And I worked in physics for 6 years altogether. I did infrared research. But during those years, I was also reading a lot of philosophy on my own, and I found Plato and Aristotle. Plato, of course, is a very artistic writer. He writes dialogues and uses incredibly vivid imagery and stories, myths, as they're called, to make a lot of his philosophical points. I was drawn to him, and Aristotle isn't like Plato in that way. As a stylist, he's much more direct and cut and dried. Even in Aristotle, I enjoyed his clarity and his precision and his determination to find the truth. Between the two of them, I fell in love with ancient philosophy. It's like a lot of things. You dive in and you realize, oh my gosh, there's a vast ocean here, and you just start swimming. You can spend the rest of your life doing that.
What is awe? How would you define that?
We use the word awesome an awful lot today. I think in a way we've cheapened the concept of awe. I looked it up in a dictionary, and what they said is that it's an emotion that consists of the combination of reverence, dread, and wonder. I found that a helpful definition. I think those three components, reverence, dread, and wonder, can be present in different degrees in different cases. For instance, if you think of something like the mushroom cloud from an atom bomb, clearly, I think, produces a sense of awe. I don't think we have any reverence for a mushroom cloud, but we have a lot of dread and probably some wonder. In fact, I think we do have wonder as well at the majesty and the power that's revealed there. That's an example of awe. But obviously, a lot of things in nature, a magnificent waterfall, a beautiful sunrise, a powerful storm can all produce a sense of awe. They're putting us in touch with powers vastly beyond our control, and also, in many cases, a kind of beauty that comes from beyond, in a sense. It's not something we create or that we would even have imagined beforehand. When you see something like a beautiful sunset, often it's the fact that, wow, who would have ever thought of making something this beautiful? Yet those are present in nature all the time. It doesn't even have to be something majestic and powerful. If you look at an insect, many insects, I think, can produce a sense of awe as you study them and marvel at how wonderfully they're put together. I saw one the other day of a beetle that had a back that's shiny and reflective, just like a mirror. That was awesome to me. Here I'm using the word awesome again. But it created a sense of awe at nature producing something very small, very compact, but beautiful and exhibiting a kind of beauty that I never would have expected. It's hard to say exactly what the constituents are. I think the dictionary is roughly correct. Often there's a sense of appreciation at a kind of beauty that we don't expect and we couldn't have envisioned, and yet here it is. That, I think, can also produce a sense of awe.
Yeah, the emotion of deep respect, dread. I would agree something as ominous and dreadful like a mushroom cloud explosion. Mm-hmm. When you mentioned that, I was thinking of even the vastness of the universe. In a way, there's a dreadful aspect to that because of how small that may make us feel. And then the third emotion, wonder, perfectly described by your beetle example. The beetle had a mirror as a back.
Wonder is something very powerful in its own right. I think it's different from awe, but also awe is an emotion by and large. It's a feeling you have, a kind of innate response that you don't necessarily reason to. Whereas wonder, I think of more as a state of mind. There's a famous saying of Aristotle that philosophy begins with a sense of wonder. He's not thinking of an emotion you feel. He's thinking of the state of mind in which you regard something as puzzling, but not just the way a crossword puzzle is puzzling, but puzzling in the sense that, oh, I know there's something important here that I want to understand. There's something here that is deeply significant, and yet it escapes my grasp. So you have a sense of wonder about that. He says that's what leads us on to philosophical reflection and to systematic inquiry. Wonder is definitely important. I mentioned the beetle. I think a lot of biology is driven by that sense of wonder at the intricate forms of life that we find in nature. A true biologist, when they see that beetle, is going to say, what makes these wings so shiny? How did the beetle get to be the way it is, right? That sense of wonder will then lead them on to further inquiry. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of thing Aristotle has in mind.
Do you think it's a skill to be able to find awe and wonder in the seemingly mundane?
That's a good question. Yes and no. I think it is something that can be cultivated, that we should try to encourage in the young and teach the young to look at the world around them, even with small children. I think we all do this kind of instinctively. We'll take a child outside and say, hey, have you noticed the leaves on this tree? Aren't they really wonderful? Look at those little curves and look at the colors. Children latch onto that and they recognize immediately what you're talking about. But having said that, the only reason I shy back from saying it's a skill, I think of a skill as something you can cultivate systematically and you can track your progress. Mm. Like a carpenter, you can track the quality of the chair or whatever it is that you're doing, or the skill of programming. You know how good you are as a programmer by the complexity of the programs you can write. And with having an appropriate sense of wonder, I think of it as more open-ended mm-hmm. than a skill typically would be. Another thing about a skill is usually there's some particular product or achievement that mm-hmm. you're aiming toward. And a sense of wonder doesn't aim at anything, really.
Yeah,
it's almost like a form of taste, in the sense of artistic taste, to be able to appreciate good music or good wine or good dancing. Those are forms of taste that you can definitely cultivate, but they're not aimed at any particular achievement. Mm-hmm. I would think of a sense of wonder as a little bit more like that.
This month's practice was an awe walk, where you go out for a walk and you notice the beauty and the awe-inspiring mm-hmm. things in mm-hmm. the world around you. Is that something that could help people if they're feeling like yeah. things are dull, mundane, or monotonous?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a great idea. It's something you can do almost any time, any place, particularly if you're outdoors. I think you could take that further. A lot of traditional education was really focused around helping you learn to notice things and then to describe or represent them. The act of trying to describe it or represent it drives you then to notice things you wouldn't notice otherwise. Not only noticing things, but then trying to verbalize for yourself how you would describe this to mm. someone in a letter, or even to draw it in a sketch. Mm. Sketching focuses the attention and forces you to notice things that generally you don't notice. Imagine trying to draw a tree. You have to pay attention to, what is that branch there? Is it the same as this other piece of the branch? And like I said, a lot of traditional education was all about these sort of skills in which you're learning to really live in the world around you mm. and not just take things for granted. I do think that's a real key to a contented life, to appreciate what we do have.
By expressing, whether through drawing or writing or talking about what we do notice, it can take us into a deeper appreciation of what we're noticing.
Absolutely.
Why do we use the word awesome to describe something positive, but then awful to describe something negative? Is that because awful is referring to the dreadfulness aspect of the emotion of awe? Why do you think that is?
Awe, if it includes dread, then there's an element of fear, at least potentially. The awe I feel of this little beetle, there's no fear involved in that. But with a mushroom cloud, there definitely is. If that fear is the dominant element, then yeah, awful would be the way we would describe it.
It's a very complex emotion and feeling, which seems appropriate because it describes some things that are incomprehensible in ways.
Part of the value of awe, or why it's so important to us, is that it helps remind us how small we are and how big the world is and how much there is in the world that we don't control. It's a good thing that we don't. In a way, that's how the world presents to us forms of beauty and things that we do find awesome. If they were things that we made, we wouldn't find them awesome. Las Vegas has incredible, stupendous neon lights. You can marvel at them. You can find them overwhelming. I wouldn't say they're an object of awe, because we know what they are. We know where they come from. We know why they're there.
And does it feel a little cheap?
Yeah, that too, right? Mm. They're there because they're part of the money-making game that's being played. Mm. Let's think of another, let's say, the Empire State Building. Mm. Very well-designed, very attractive, appealing skyscraper. I do find it beautiful. I don't find it an object of awe, not the way that the sunset is, or even the beetle. Because, again, it's a human artifact. And as such, I understand why they made it, roughly how they made it, what it's there for. Awe, seems to me, is part of how we connect emotionally to the world that's beyond the human world. I think that's very important for us as human beings, again, to realize that we're just part of something much, much bigger than ourselves.
There's an aspect of mystery in awe. And when there's an absence of mystery, there's an absence of awe.
Like I said, the dictionary says reverence is one constituent of awe. And I don't think that's true in every case. I think often it's true. Any of the great religions are going to have some aspect of awe and reverence. I think of the story of, say, Moses at the burning bush, where he sees this bush burning in the middle of the desert. He goes to see what it is, and the voice speaks to him, and it's the voice of God. Tells him, take off your sandals, for you stand on holy ground. It's an object of awe, wonder, and reverence all there together. That episode encapsulates that really well. A book that we read in my philosophy religion class, the Bhagavad Gita, is a Hindu classic, where Arjuna is the young man, the prince, in a chariot, and he has this companion, Krishna, whom initially he asks for advice, but as they're conversation unfolds, it turns out that Krishna actually is a god. You might say even higher than a god. He's all of reality. And he unfolds this to Arjuna. Arjuna is definitely overwhelmed with a sense of reverence and awe. It climaxes in this grand theophany where he sees all the worlds and all the other gods entering into the mouth of Krishna in order to be absorbed and consumed in the great consummation of all things. It's a very awesome episode and encounter that he has. Awe connects us to that which is greater than ourselves. And that's paradigmatically true of religion. Religion is, by its nature, the attempt to connect ourselves to that which is much greater. So awe and reverence are really essential to any religion.
In the process of connecting us to that which is greater than us, we experience awe. Would you say awe blows our minds or deconstructs our logical reasoning of the world around us? Do you think awe has that effect on us?
Yeah, it can. That's a good question. A lot of people really seek that and almost thirst for it. That's part of the appeal of drugs. Or even alcohol, really. Anything that alters your consciousness a little bit and gets you to relax and disentangle from the conventions and assumptions that we normally make about the world. People seek that and often find it liberating. I don't say always, because it can also be dangerous. Was your question, does awe contribute to that?
Yeah, when Krishna reveals the reality of the way it is to Arjuna, do you think Arjuna is undergoing a process where how he sees the world is now deconstructed in this process of this awe-inspiring experience?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. He sees the ultimate reality of the way things are, and it makes all of the world that he normally experiences seem very small and transitory in relation to that. And in fact, it's so overwhelming, he begs Krishna, stop it, I can't take any more. You know, let me see you again in your human form, which he does.
We have a similar experience in a micro way, where if we allow ourselves to be open to these experiences, maybe a part of our rational thinking becomes deconstructed in a way that leads us to a new way of seeing things.
Well, I think a big part of the value, at least for me, is that it does remind us how small our own ambitions, desires, and goals are in the great scheme of things. Most of the day, we have tasks we have to do. They're important in our own minds, and understandably, if you have to do it, then you've got to focus on that. But you also need to be able to get away and step back and realize the world is so much bigger than anything I'm aiming for, anything I can hope to achieve. There's a kind of liberation in that. That's also why getting out into nature, camping, hiking, getting away, getting to the beach, we all value those things a lot. I think that's part of the value that we find in them. Speaking of awe, one of the great sources of awe is the ocean. I think that's part of why the beach is such a refreshing and rejuvenating place. You're able to walk out and feel on your feet this majestic thing that is so huge, so powerful, and has been there long, long before humanity and will be there long after. It's the sort of mother that we came from in some sense. There's something very powerful about that experience that puts us into the context of that which is greater than ourselves.
Would you say that awe relates to beauty?
Yes, it does, although I'm not sure that there's a simple way to describe that relationship. I was thinking about the mushroom cloud again. Is that something beautiful? That's not normally how I would describe it. I could see why you might, but to me, the sense of dread and fear would overwhelm, perhaps, an appreciation of beauty. Beauty seems a little bit inappropriate for something that's so incredibly destructive and dangerous. But that's just my intuition about beauty and how we use that word.
Based on your intuition, your experience, how would you define beauty?
This is something that comes up a lot in ancient philosophy, particularly in Plato. He writes a good deal about beauty. And love, or eros, which is the source of our words like erotic, and it simply means a strong, passionate desire, which is our innate human response to beauty. Plato says that eros is not so much the desire to possess beauty, because there's a kind of natural fecundity. It's the tendency to bring forth offspring, to produce, to beget. He thinks that eros by its nature has that drive within it to bring forth something. The way he defines eros, it's the desire to bring forth beauty within the beautiful. He says we're all pregnant in soul, and we're seeking one in whom to bring forth that which is within us. He sees it as relational in that way. It's not just an abstract appreciation, it's the desire to bring forth what you have within you in a way you can only do through your engagement
with another person?
With another.
It sounds like it's more like a verb.
Eros is a noun, but it refers to this desire and this passionate drive toward something or someone. That something or someone is beautiful. It's the thing that draws you, and the beauty in it is what draws you. The thing that he points out is beauty can exist in different ways, on different levels. You can be transformed in the process of being drawn to and seeking beauty so that you come to appreciate different forms of beauty that you didn't initially. He puts this in terms of what he calls the ladder of love, that love, eros, typically starts with a kind of a physical attraction to bodily beauty. Of course, we've all experienced that, and it's an innate biological drive. He says that the lover then, because of this impulse to bring forth beauty within the beautiful, within the beloved, is going to want to consider, what is it that will make the beloved even more beautiful? Or what is it that I appreciate and enjoy in the beloved? Then the lover will naturally be drawn from that, or led upward from beauty of body to beauty of soul. Because beauty of body is wonderful, of course, but it's not the sort of thing that you can dwell upon and enjoy endlessly, you might say.
It's relative.
And it's relatively superficial, which is not to knock it. We all know that someone who's merely attractive at a physical level, that attraction doesn't go as deep and doesn't form a foundation for a lasting relationship, in the same way as someone in whom you find that the physical beauty is just the surface appearance of something that's much deeper, namely the beauty of soul. He says that the lover, in the process of seeking to bring forth beauty, is going to be led upward from physical beauty to beauty of soul. It doesn't stop there either, because you have the same question that the lover is facing. What is it I want to bring forth within the soul of the beloved? It's wisdom or virtue of some kind. It's some kind of state of soul. In other words, the lover is asking, well, what is it that I'm drawn to here in the first place that makes the soul beautiful? It's going to be those things. Then the lover wants to find that sort of beauty. He sees this as a kind of a ladder that ultimately, for Plato at least, is going to lead beyond the attraction to any one individual person. Because as the lover is ascending this ladder, the lover is coming to appreciate virtue, wisdom, and traits of character in their own right, then to be asking these larger questions, what makes those beautiful? That's where the lover is asking about beauty itself and seeking beauty in many different forms. Plato, as a philosopher, would definitely include something like the beauty of geometry or the beauty of mathematics and other kinds of abstract beauty as forms of beauty that we're not drawn to with that initial physical attraction. As we reflect on beauty in all its different forms, we come to appreciate those more and more. Plato says there's beauty with, you might say, a capital B, that is the original source in which all the different things that we call beautiful or we find beautiful, beauty of body, beauty of soul, beauty of different kinds of knowledge and character, beauty of mathematics, in which they're all unified. The way he understands it is those different forms of beauty are like images of beauty itself. That's a very powerful metaphor, because one thing can have images that are all very different from each other. If you think of the different photographs there are of you and your reflection in the mirror and your shadow on the floor, those are images, but they're very different from each other. And they can be more or less adequate or more or less revealing or representative of what you are, but none of them comes anywhere close to what you actually are, simply because of the fact that they're images. He thinks of all the different things that we find beautiful as images, ultimately, of beauty itself. For Plato, what his philosophy is all about is coming to see the things that we experience with our senses in this world as images of a higher reality.
And of thereby, the big B beauty.
Yeah. He believes in what are called the forms, and this would be the form of beauty. It's the intrinsic reality that exists in its own right, apart from any human perception or awareness, yet it enables human perception and awareness. It enables us even to have the concepts that we do, such as the concept of beauty. Now, it helps to realize, when you think about something like this, that the word he's using is kalos, is a little different from the word beauty in English. I think beauty in English does have the connotation of immediately visually appealing, and therefore very much a matter of personal taste. Whereas kalos in Greek is not a matter of personal taste. It's something that is intrinsically worthy of admiration. It can also be translated noble or fine. It's the word for an aristocrat or aristocratic status to be kalos. He does see it as a transformative process because as you come to recognize and enjoy higher and higher forms of beauty, you're changing as a person. And you're no longer going to have the same kind of self-seeking motive of, say, someone who's just drawn purely to what's physically attractive.
It seems very clear that there's an inward beauty, which may be more objective, more absolute, which opens doors to even more subtle forms of beauty, ultimately leading to a big B beauty or an absolute beauty.
I've always found it helpful to think of them in that way. Otherwise, outward beauty can be easy to trivialize because our culture and economy encourage us to think of it in a trivial way. We all know that photos can be touched up and that models have makeup artists that make them look really beautiful, and actors and actresses have workout coaches so they have the perfect abs and everything else. If you think of beauty just as what's produced as a kind of a market product, and a quality you have to look good on screen and thereby to make loads of money, that trivializes what it actually is. Plato thinks of it as the appearance in the sensory world of something that is higher and has intrinsic value in its own right. Now, you can fake it to some degree, that's true, but that doesn't mean that it's not real and that it's not something to be valued as an indication or a kind of a stepping stone to a higher reality. That's the more classical way that people think of beauty. That's why if you look at ancient sculpture, for instance, or even the sculpture of the Renaissance, they were imitating the ancients. It's all about this. It's all about representing the human form in a way that isn't just casually appealing, but is rather revealing the intrinsic beauty that's there, thereby ennobling us and enabling us to think of ourselves in a higher way than we would otherwise.
You're saying there's a level of honesty with those Renaissance sculptures. Like AI, Photoshop, they create human shapes and human bodies that only computers can create.
AI is a great example of that because it can now produce any image that you want. The very fact that it's catered to your desires should already make you suspicious of what this is. But real beauty isn't like that. Real beauty isn't catering to you. It is what it is. In nature, when you find the sunset beautiful or the waterfall beautiful, part of what's appealing about it is it's not trying to please you at all. It simply has its own reality.
Does the big B beauty exist in the seemingly ugly? Does big B beauty exist in all things?
Oh my, that's a hard question. I want to say yes, but at the same time, I don't want to trivialize that there are things that truly are ugly and truly are horrific. Disease comes to mind. We were talking about the atom bomb a minute ago. Let me try to approach this the way Plato would. I think Plato would say yes, because anything that is, insofar as it is, you might say, insofar as it has real being, partakes of the beautiful. At the same time, there are many ways of falling short of the beautiful. Disease would be, I think, a good case of that, because disease by its nature is a falling short from health, by definition. We often do find it repugnant, and it is repugnant. I think that's usually the right response to have. It's repugnant because we recognize something is missing here, something is wrong. In that very act, we're recognizing what this thing should be. We're aware of an absence, and something incredibly destructive, like warfare. Of course, warfare takes many forms, and they're always ugly. They're always horrible. It would be ridiculous to say that there's beauty in the aftermath of a battle, say, with all these corpses on the ground. That's not beauty. Nonetheless, the human form is something beautiful. The human body is something beautiful. And when we see it mangled and disfigured, like in the aftermath of a battle. It's like looking at something with disease. We recognize the ugliness there is precisely the absence of what ought to be. It's the awareness of beauty that produces the awareness of ugliness as well. Ugliness is like the shadow that's cast by the absence of beauty. If it's still a human body at all, then to that extent there's still something beautiful within it, even though it's mangled and horribly disfigured. I think there's that underlying awareness of beauty that we have in everything, even when what we mainly realize or recognize is the beauty that's absent.
Even when horrible things happen, the beauty that exists in it is the beauty that we believe ought to have been?
Yeah, and that we recognize is still there to the extent that the thing is there at all. The human body, mangled and disfigured, if it's still a human body, it still has the beauty of the human form. And it's the tragedy of our existence, perhaps of life in the world, that we're capable of doing that. We're capable of mangling and distorting.
Yeah.
Go a little further. This is an unfortunate fact about human psychology, that a lot of people, in fact, take pleasure and seek that deliberately, which is to take pleasure in the infliction of pain and the destruction of beauty. A lot of movies today, I think, are doing this. They're putting you into a very dark place deliberately. For whatever reason, people respond to that. They seem to want that.
Children want to test their parents. They test the boundaries. What am I capable of? What can I do? Mm-hmm. Where is the line? It's possible that all of us have this little tug at that same thing. Where's my line? What I see is sometimes we see that as a source of power, and sometimes we desire to be powerful. What do you think?
I was just reading a famous episode in Augustine's Confessions, St. Augustine, the early Christian author. Okay. He tells about how when he was a boy, he and his friends used to go out, and the neighbor had a pear tree that grew a lot of pears. They would like to climb the pear tree and take the pears, rip the pears off and throw them to the ground. They didn't want to eat the pears. They didn't have a grudge against the neighbor. They just enjoyed destruction for the sake of destruction. Or the way he puts it was, I enjoyed doing evil because it was evil. I knew it was wrong, and that's why I enjoyed it. He recounts this wondering at himself. I mentioned philosophy begins with a sense of wonder. We ourselves are objects of wonder. There's a great deal in us that's puzzling. He finds this puzzling in himself. Why did he want to do that and enjoy it? And not only him, but his friends too. There is something that I think we can all recognize. Yeah, I've got some of that in me too. What he finally decides is that it's like I wanted to be God. I wanted that sense of omnipotence of I can do this and no one can stop me and no one's going to punish me. I can do what I want, and I'm going to show that off by just destroying these pears for no reason at all. He is a Christian. He thinks this is a kind of a negative image of the fact that I'm made for God. I am made to be in relationship to God, to know God, to love God, and to serve God. When I don't have that presence of God in my life, I then seek to make it up out of myself and to make myself into God. That's at least how he understands this human impulse that, in a way, you might say, seeks the dark side. Evil has a fascination of its own. It's because we have within us that hole, you might say. At least that's the way Augustine thinks. It's like a God-shaped hole within us. If God isn't actually there, then it's just a big darkness. That darkness then drives us into very dark places.
Awe and beauty, how would you relate those to truth, if they relate at all?
That, again, is a deep question. We've already talked a little bit about how awe is an emotion. It's a very valuable emotion because it connects us to that which is greater than ourselves. In that sense, I think there's something about it that reveals truth that otherwise we wouldn't be aware of and wouldn't have the same access to. I see awe at least in that sense, as enabling us to recognize truth. I think the same thing is true of beauty. The awareness of beauty enables us to appreciate and enjoy things in the world that we wouldn't appreciate and enjoy otherwise, to respond to them appropriately, because again, I think that beauty is something real, and that by recognizing and enjoying it, we're actually responding to what's really there. In that sense, beauty also enables us to recognize forms of truth that we couldn't otherwise. There is a view among scholastic philosophers of the Middle Ages that beauty, truth, and goodness are all different ways of naming God. Mm. They're different names for the highest ultimate reality. We see all of these attributes, beauty, goodness, truth, and unity, in all different forms because all of reality is deriving from that highest ultimate reality. You could go even further, in which beauty and truth are both, you might say, names for God.
Beauty and truth are both names for God.
Yeah. Yeah.
If someone was tuning in for the last bit, what's some advice you would give them?
I'm not sure this is a very profound answer. I can say from my own experience, like I mentioned, I was a physics major as an undergraduate, and I'd always thought of science as the way to find truth, because in high school, that's the place where you find clear, definite answers that can be supported by evidence. And math, in its own way, also, the same is true. There are clear procedures for finding what's true. I really appreciated that, and that's what drew me to science and to math. I ultimately realized when I took an English course with a professor of Renaissance literature that there are other ways of finding truth, and they involve beauty. A lot of this goes back to what we were just discussing. I found mathematics beautiful. I found physics beautiful. But he opened my eyes to the beauty of words, the beauty of poetry, beauty of rhythm. So getting back to your question, what kind of advice would be implicit in that? It would be to be open to the experience of forms of beauty that are not necessarily those that your education perhaps presented to you, or that your own way of thinking about the world necessarily is focused on. Look for other kinds of beauty and be respectful of other kinds of beauty that people find in the world, and trust that there's value at the end.
Thank you for listening to Becoming Wildly Resilient. This podcast is brought to you by University of Kentucky Human Resources Health and Wellness. We offer a wide range of online and in-person services to support the well-being of UK employees, retirees, and their spouses. You can find experts in mental health, personal resilience, nutrition, and physical activity. We're ready to meet you where you are and address your unique needs. To learn more about the work life and well-being services offered by UK Human Resources, visit hr.uky.edu/well-being. You can also connect with us on social media and YouTube by searching at UKY Wellness or by email at healthandwellness@uky.edu.